Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We are going to begin by talking about the concept of drinking from the cup. Yesterday, we had the gospel reading. James and John's mother kneels before Christ, and they ask that her sons may sit at his right and at his left in the kingdom. Her request has an historical context. When you think about the kingdom of Israel, and if you know salvation history, you would understand that the loss of the kingdom typically means the loss of the unified kingdom that David built, that Solomon then reigned in, but caused a tremendous disappointment. And so his son Rehoboam became the cause of the separation of the kingdom. Ever since then, whenever Israel thinks of the concept of a kingdom, they're thinking of the unified kingdom of Israel, 12 tribes living in harmony in one unified, faithful, covenantal, liturgical kingdom. She makes this request to Jesus, saying, may my sons sit on your left and right as your ministers, as your key ministers, so that everyone will affiliate them with your kingship. She has no idea what she's talking about. And so Christ then answers, are they willing to drink the cup that I'm about to drink? Now, she understood immediately. She understood immediately the context of a cup, but she still didn't understand that he was talking about the cup of a humiliating crucifixion. Neither did James and John, because they said, of course we are. Because the language of drinking from the cup in Scripture has to do with suffering. It has to do with endurance. It has to do with a time of trial. And that's why Christ says, take this cup from me. I want to explore this language of drinking from the cup throughout the Scriptures, just so that we can understand Jesus' full context. And by the time he gets to the Garden of Gethsemane, we realize that the cup is finally drank on Calvary, on the cross. And James and John, quite frankly, do sit on Christ's left and right. James is the first to be martyred. John is the last of the apostles to die. So I'll explore all of that. We go on from there to speak with my dear friend, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, about the life of Fulton Sheen, how he met Fulton Sheen in person, and sharing his memories. But we also think about Jimmy Lai and the rise of communism. Now, this is a really crucial conversation. Matthew and I were blessed to have this conversation on the Good News Cruise. And Matthew knew Fulton Sheen briefly. And again, the insights are invaluable. All this after the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, March 5th. It's the feast of St. John Joseph of the Cross. And today's news is brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. Kristi Noem is out as Homeland Security Secretary after being fired by the president. In a post on Truth Social, President Trump said Oklahoma Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen will replace her at the end of the month. Trump said Noem has served the U.S. well and will become Special Envoy for the Shield of Americans, a new initiative in the Western Hemisphere that's set to be announced on Saturday. President Trump says he must have a role in choosing Iran's next supreme leader. The president told Axios the son of the late supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is an unacceptable choice. Trump told reporters at the White House this week that most of the people we had in mind are dead when asked about his potential picks to succeed Khamenei. The Vatican's top diplomat is criticizing the U.S. and Israel's strikes on Iran. Cardinal Pietro Parolin told the Vatican News the attacks undermine international law. He went on to say the rule of force has replaced the force of law. On Sunday, Pope Leo called for the countries involved to stop the spiral of violence before it becomes an irreparable abyss. The first American pontiff did not address the conflict in Iran during his audience in St. Peter's Square on Wednesday. And a number of European nations are moving naval assets to Cyprus to help protect it from Iranian strikes. Spain, Italy, France, and the Netherlands are sending Navy ships and aircraft carriers to the European Union island nation. It comes after a British Royal Air Force base on the island was targeted by a drone. The UK also announced it would be deploying its warship and helicopters to deter drone strikes in Cyprus. With your Ave Maria Radio.net news, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mark Sweeter. In Matthew chapter 20, James and John's mother kneels before Christ and asks, command that these two sons of mine may sit, one at your right, one at your left in your kingdom. So yes, a mother kneels before Christ and asks for glory. She wants proximity to power for her sons. This is a very typical Jewish mother thing to do based on all my conversations with my friend Steve Ray. She wants visible honor, recognizable authority, seats of influence. And her request is coming from a place where of history. She still thinks that the kingdom of the Messiah is going to be a glorious, earthly, political, Davidic kingdom. She also loves her children. She believes in them. She wants a kingdom and imagines them enthroned beside its king. Jesus' response in that sense is bizarre. You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink? In that single question, he shifts the entire conversation. It's not about status. They need to join him in sacrifice. They want prominence, and he's saying, well, okay, join me in my suffering. They want earthly triumph, and he's saying, okay, then you have to be covenantally obedient. In the scriptures, that language of the cup has a heavy history. We need to go far back here. In Psalm 75, the cup in the Lord's hand foams with judgment against Israel and the nations. In Isaiah 51, Jerusalem drinks the cup of wrath, and they stagger. In Jeremiah 25, the nations drink and fall before divine justice. The cup signifies a portion assigned by God, an allotted destiny within his providential plan. And frankly, it often has a connotation to some kind of suffering and judgment. So when Jesus speaks of drinking his cup, he's talking about entering fully into the suffering that secures our redemption. He's talking about Gethsemane. All of the cups that have been spoken of beforehand were going to culminate in his great cup. And so he prays, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me, not as I will, but as you will. Because the language of the cup, in even Jewish theology, is about obedience unto death. The cup is the language of covenant fulfillment, and therefore covenant faithfulness, even to the shedding of blood. Because even in the old covenant, wine was a symbol of the blood. And so the wine that was drank from a cup often had some kind of symbolic tie to the blood sacrifices of the liturgy. James and John answer with confidence, we are able. Now, it's sincerity, sure, but they have no comprehension. They are imagining courage, they imagine they will have resolve, they imagine loyalty, but they have no concept of the weight of the cup that Christ will raise in the garden. They're thinking of military conquest and might, and they're willing to fight in the grand war, but they don't have a vision of the humiliating crucifixion Christ will endure. And so Jesus affirms that sure, you will drink my cup, because he knows that the two of them will die for him, eventually. James will become the first apostle to be martyred, struck down by Herod's sword. John will endure exile, persecution, and long endurance for the sake of the gospel. And so the first and the last to die would be these two brothers. In that sense, they really are seated on the left and right of the king. They will indeed share in the Messiah's suffering. But the Lord clarifies authority within the kingdom. To sit at my right hand and my left is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. Christ here is anchoring the concept of glory in his Father's sovereign will with suffering and his divine providence. If you want honor in the covenant, well, it flows from divine preparation, from God's eternal wisdom, from the mysterious ordering of grace. We can't strive for glory in God's kingdom in the same way, even if you can do so in an earthly manner. So when the other 10 hear of the request, well, they all get indignant. Their rivalry surfaces and comparison emerges. Their reaction actually exposes how deeply the human heart craves recognition. This is not in some of us, it's in all of us. Jesus gathers them and instructs them with solemn clarity. You know the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. Their great men exercise authority over them. In the ancient world, power expressed itself through dominance. Kings secured loyalty through force. Governors displayed superiority through forceful coercion. And so they received honor by means of coercing it, frankly. And Christ overturns the entire structure. It won't be so among you. If you want to be great, you must be the servant. whoever would be first among you must be your slave. And in these words, he establishes the reversed law of the kingdom. It's bizarre to all of us, and yet this is what makes sense. Authority kneels before the Lord. In the Greek text, the word for servant is diakonos, where we get the English word deacon. Typically, the diakonos, the servant, is one who ministers at the table, in this case, of the liturgy. But the word for slave is doulos, and that's an entirely different category. Within the covenant family, then, not all of us are called to be deacons who minister at the table, but all of us are called to be doulos, to serve with a sense of surrender. If we want to elevate ourselves, we need to be humble. And this, again, I say this for me more than anyone else. Jesus grounds this teaching in his own mission. The covenant life of the Christian reaches this summit, even as the Son of Man came to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Now, in invoking the title Son of Man, he's looking at Daniel 7. A figure like a Son of Man receives dominion, glory, a kingdom that shall never pass away. But that majestic ruler approaches the Ancient of Days, who is God, and he receives everlasting authority. But the same Son of Man declares his kingdom expresses itself through service and through the giving of his life as a ransom. The term ransom, to understand that, well, we've got to go back to Exodus 6. The Lord promises to redeem Israel with an outstretched arm. In the ancient Near Eastern context, a ransom price was what was paid to liberate a captive from bondage. Typically, a captive that's put in bondage is put into servitude and slavery. You paid a ransom price for their freedom. The Greek word here, lutron, is a payment that frees slaves. So Jesus is identifying his own life as the ransom price to free the slaves into freedom, because he is saying that his death is what's going to deliver us from the slavery of being in the captivity of the evil one. His blood was going to secure us freedom from sin and death. Through his obedience, he renewed humanity. So his throne is inseparable from the cross. The right and left of Christ will indeed be occupied. But if you take a look at the crucifixion narrative, it wasn't what James and John envisioned. In Matthew's gospel, when Jesus hangs crucified, if the cross of Christ is the throne of Christ, then look at his left and right. Two criminals are placed there. And the positions of perceived glory now become clear for all to see. It's a place of shared suffering with him. The kingdom of Christ manifests itself through cruciform love. This passage strikes our modern hearts. It makes us uncomfortable, to be sure. And this is why. We all want influence, even within the church, within society, within family. Many of us want to shape history, to guide institutions, to stand near visible power. All of us have that struggle. But Christ redefines that influence. He tells us to empty ourselves. He tells fathers, serve your households through sacrificial fidelity. He tells pastors, shepherd through personal holiness and tireless care. He tells mothers, offer daily hidden gifts of patience and endurance. He tells every disciple, drink the cup assigned by the Father. That teaching ought to reshape how we think about our vocations. In baptism, each believer enters the new covenant sealed in Christ's blood. Each receives a share in his priestly, prophetic, and royal mission. Royal dignity in the gospel is always about service. So what's the cup? Am I willing to receive a portion that the Father assigns? Am I prepared to endure the suffering, the cross, the misunderstanding, the loss, the sacrifice, or faithfulness? Am I ready to measure greatness by conformity to Christ? Those questions are the core of our discipleship. They separate us from the worldly concept of glory to the heavenly concept of glory. In the end, seats of honor in the kingdom belong to those conformed to the crucified and risen Lord. His authority flows from love poured out on the cross. His crown is one of thorns that he wants to share with us. His exaltation is by means of nails through his hands and feet. His heart is bared out by means of a spear pierced through his side. If we embrace that pattern, we enter the heart of the covenant, because we learn that proximity to Christ and his glory means saying, Lord, I will share your cup. And mind you, that's perhaps the most difficult thing any of us can pray, and yet that is the call of Christianity. we discover that true Christian greatness blossoms in that way. Our lives become centered on Jesus, whose throne stands forever as the cross of redeeming love. Stay tuned, I'm Marcus Peter.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
In her diary, St. Faustina wrote, "If only I had a spiritual director from the beginning, I would not have wasted so many of God's graces. If even the saints needed spiritual guidance, how much more do we?" The nonprofit Revive app lets you meet virtually with certified spiritual companions, scheduling sessions at your convenience, helping you grow closer to Christ. Your first two sessions are free. Download the Revive app today. That's R-E-V-I-V, and then the number 3.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Do you feel as though life is flying past you? Are you desperate for a way to find moments of peace and quiet? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian prayer series, will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. We're doing something different today. Some time ago, I was blessed to sit down with my friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen in person on the Good News Cruise to talk about church news and current events. We got to talk about the time Matthew met Archbishop Fulton Sheen in person. I want to go straight to that conversation now.
I want to start with the happy news. A hero of mine who, you know well, in Malaysia, I didn't have Catholic resources, right. But this man's work I was able to download for free because it was Creative Commons. Yep. Archbishop Fulton Sheen.
Yes.
The beatification is finally moving forward.
It is. This was joyous news. We had the word from the Diocese of Peoria, Bishop Pilka, that he had received the green light to proceed with the beatification. Now, he's the one who made the announcement because the cause in this case started in Peoria, where Fulton J. Sheen was born. And so he's the one who received, interestingly enough, not an email, not a Zoom call, not a Teams message, not even FaceTime from the Holy Father. It was a letter that arrived in a diplomatic pouch to the Apostolic Nunciature in Washington, D.C., and then was relayed to Bishop Tilka, because this is a very formal process.
Mm-hmm.
And the only problem we have, and amidst all of this joyous news, is that we don't actually have a formal date yet set for the beatification. The assumption is that it will be this year. The other assumption is probably September, something like that, because an event like this, especially in the U.S., is going to take a lot of time to prepare, and there's going to be, I could see everyone in this room, you, me, we're all very interested in this. So then the next question is where it will happen. The assumption has been for a while it would be Peoria, but it could be other places, like the nearest large city. Mm. In this case, it would be St. Louis. So you can be very fortunate if you live in St. Louis.
And for the rest of us, we're going to fight tooth and nail to be there.
Yes, we will.
Now, there are a lot of issues that have hit us because of just the nature of Fulton Sheen's work, but also the time in which he was doing the work.
Right.
We've talked about this in the past, but before we go into the weeds of those, yep. One of the issues we've spoken about, too, is Peoria wants to claim him.
Yes.
New York wants to claim him.
Yes.
And there's a long history of ministry where typically canonized individuals are remembered for where they did the ministry, right? So
right.
Peter of Rome, James of Jerusalem, Anthony of Padua.
That's right.
Now, just given that history, tell us about the issue here.
Yeah, the counter-argument would be somebody like Francis Xavier.
Oh, of course. Yeah, we don't call him Francis of Japan or Malaysia, that's right. Right.
We should, but he'd be buried, of course, in Goa.
So oh, Goa, that's right. Yeah, Francis of Goa, that
Francis
would be cool.
Francis of Goa. In this case, Fulton J. Sheen spent so many years as an auxiliary bishop in New York, and if we have some time, I'd love to just go back a little bit about his life, because he is so remarkable a figure. Both in terms of his intellect and also his holiness. But he served as an auxiliary bishop in New York and did remarkable work there as the head of the Pontifical Mission Society, and then was appointed in the 60s to the Diocese of Rochester. By that point, however, he was a mainstay and had been for decades in television and radio. I'm going to guess that almost everyone joining us here today has seen or heard Fulton J. Sheen in their lifetime, either on radio or in television. I had the great privilege of knowing him as a kid. So proving that I am a relic, I guess I'd be classified as either the third or can you be a fourth class relic that you shook,
because he shook his hand. Well, maybe just your hand, you know?
Just my hand, yes. In this case, though, He came to Hawaii when I was a kid, and he stopped a couple of times and actually had dinner in my house. I served Fulton J. Sheen dinner as a little kid.
You're just rubbing this in at this point.
He had magnificent table manners, that's all I can say. But even as a kid, and he was elderly by that point, this is around 1974, so he died about 5 years later, he was still, the word I've always used about him is a colossus. He's a colossus in Catholic media. He was a colossus in the intellectual world. But to your question, too, here was someone who, in his time, was a global figure, too, in Catholicism. So as an auxiliary, as his Bishop of Rochester, and then he retired and spent those last years traveling the world, speaking, reaching out, raising money still for the pontifical missions. This was one of the greatest communicators in the history of the church, and one of the greatest, certainly one of the greatest Catholic communicators of the 20th century. You could make the argument along with Mother Angelica, but I think Fulton J. Sheen, I think she would say that Fulton J. Sheen was the greatest Catholic communicator of the 20th century. We always have to salute as well and add into that mix Pope St. John Paul II, whose extraordinary travels changed the world. But in his own way, so did Fulton J. Sheen.
Boy. And, okay, so just to sort of end on a slightly humorous note, but also to talk about his just physical visage on camera, the man knew how to work the camera well.
Yes.
So here's this anti-Catholic, new Pentecostal man, and in Malaysia, no less, and I have no Catholic resources to really study the faith. A bunch of Googling led me to this man named Archbishop Fulton Sheen. I pull up one of these videos, and I'm wondering, why is this guy walking around, writing on a chalkboard, dressed like Batman?
That's right. Well, I've seen comparisons too. Why is he dressed like Dracula?
Because he had the worse. That's right.
Exactly. you're right. And this is the thing that was so remarkable when he began his television show. He'd been on radio for years and years and years and had one of the highest audiences in the United States for radio. And then somehow came up with the idea, and someone asked him if he'd be interested in doing television. So he went on NBC. And not only was he successful, he had millions of viewers every week. And you said something really important. His show consisted of, it had almost no graphics other than the slate.
Yeah, no props.
Right. Fulton J. Sheen. And he would come out dressed, as you said, this magnificent cassock and all of that, fariolo and all of that. And he would just stand there looking at the camera. And he had the most dramatic way of speaking directly to camera. And then, at a certain point, he would walk up, and you're right. All he had, the only prop he had, was a chalkboard, and he would write. And the thing about it was that he had a massive Catholic audience, but he also had a massive Protestant audience. My late mom told the story that when she was a kid, she went into some homes of some Lutherans and began talking to their daughter, and they all went, "Shh, shh, Fulton J. Sheen is on." So she had no idea who that was, but then quickly learned about it, and that, I think, is one of those little things that also led to her conversion to Catholicism from the Episcopalians. But it was must-see television. And he beat out the likes of legendary television figures like Milton Berle, who complained about it, but affectionately. And of course, Sheen won the Emmy Award. And very famously, when he got up to accept it, he said, "I want to thank my writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John."
Oh, my favorite
joke.
But
he had no script. He never used a script. He was simply given the topic, or he would choose the topic, and then he would just unfold everything that he knew on this particular subject. And he's the subject seemed endless. He, in an era of, now when we look back, sort of baseline morality, there was a certain common language that we could have. So he had these great literary references. He could convoke and invoke Shakespeare. He could quote the great poets, Dante and others. But he was also able to speak to the hearts of people all over the United States and all over the world in a language that they could understand. And I've often wondered if he were around today, what the reaction would be to him and how he would respond to the efforts inevitably to cancel him, how he would address that. And I think the more we can think in those terms, the more we can also lean on his wisdom and his teachings, always faithful, always orthodox, in responding to the great cultural crises of our time. Because he was brilliant in anticipating the problems that we have today.
We're going to pause my conversation with Dr. Matthew Bunsen there and go on to our break, but we're continuing on the other side. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Hello friends, Deacon Harold Burke Sivers here, and I haven't been this excited about an up-and-coming speaker for a long time, Dr. Marcus Peter. Dr. Peter has the gift of combining deep theological insight, wisdom, and knowledge with personal testimony and story in a way that makes the power of the church's teaching and God's love felt deeply in the heart of all who hear him. If you are looking for someone for your next conference, parish mission, or event, look no further than Dr. Marcus Peter.
visit MarcusBPeter.com to book Dr. Marcus Peter to speak at your event. At the Ave Maria website, you can continue the discussion and education through the Ave Maria Radio's links to social media. Ave Maria Radio has accounts on Facebook, X, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and find the social media symbols at the top of your screen.
He is honored by the Church as a saint with the title of the Angelic Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Thomas Aquinas wrote a basic textbook for young theology students that became the Church's most famous guide to the faith, the Summa Theologica. It helped him earn the title Doctor of the Church. He died in 1274.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria, Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. As I mentioned in the first segment, I was blessed to have sat down with my dear friend, Dr. Matthew Bunsen. The funny thing is, for as close as we are as friends and as much as we collaborate, we don't actually get to meet up with each other in person a lot. And so the rare occasion where we do get to do that for work events, we are blessed to be able to share in camaraderie and brotherhood. And the fact that we are brothers in arms in this mission of evangelization for the salvation of souls, this was one such occasion we were blessed to have connected on the Good News Cruise. Matthew and I are talking about Archbishop Fulton Sheen. But this is not just the surface level. He was a good theological teacher. We're going to address that, sure. Archbishop Fulton Sheen was also a man who had his finger on the pulse of history and society because the faith taught him to do that. And Matthew's going to help draw that out. And then after that, we will speak about Jimmy Lai and the situation that's happening in Hong Kong. Let's go on to that conversation.
We remember him for his catechetical work, masterful catechetical work. And like you mentioned, capacity of commentating well on camera and radio. But the man was not only a masterful catechist, he was also a philosopher, theologian, and culture commentator. And in a lot of ways, he pioneered the kind of Catholic, even Christian cultural commentary that, that you and I do today.
That's right. So for those who may not be familiar with his background, he studied for the priesthood, and he studied also at the University of Louvain, or Leuven, in Belgium. And he was such a phenomenal student in working for his dissertation, his thesis, his dissertation in his doctorate for philosophy, that he was awarded what's called the Désiré Cardinal Mercier Award for the grandeur of his thought. Then he went to Rome and studied for a doctorate in sacred theology from the Angelicum, the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas. So this is somebody who had two different doctorates, the highest doctorates that you could receive, one in philosophy, one in theology. He found that an absolutely essential grounding, but it was also his understanding, is you said something really important, Marcus, and that is to understand culture, where we are, where he was at that moment in culture. And I say that too because, as a commentator, he was able to be positioned perfectly to see the isms of the 20th century. He was very much concerned, for example, about secularism, materialism, communism, and socialism.
Yeah.
All of those we're grappling with today. I've said it on your show many times that when it comes, for example, to the popes, if the world had listened to the popes over the centuries, the world would be a much happier, more stable, prosperous, and spiritually grounded place. In the same way, I think, had more people listened to the wisdom of Fulton J. Sheen about those isms, we would be in a much happier spot, too.
I agree. His commentary on communism, I think we've all but forgotten it, but and every prediction he put forth turned out to be true, and that actually presents a great segue. He warned us about the dangers of totalitarian government.
Yes.
He warned us what happens if we don't take all of these Christian heritages across history well, if we take it for granted. And Hong Kong is showing us where we might go if we don't preserve our heritage right now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So we have in the People's Republic of China, we have some coverage in the National Catholic Register. The title of the piece is Jimmy Lai's Sentence of 20 Years. It's a stark symbol of authoritarian overreach. And it's an apt title, but in some ways it even downplays what is happening in Hong Kong, because Hong Kong is the next step for the People's Republic. We have seen what they've done in China. We have seen not just the Chinese Catholic Patriotic Church, which is the state-controlled church. We have seen the effort on the part of the government of Premier Xi Jinping to embark on what they call sinicization, which is the transformation of all of the religions that exist in China into a model that mirrors the Chinese Communist Party and what they see, at least, is Chinese culture. Now, let's be realistic, that 1949, that's how long communism has been in charge of China. So to claim that somehow communism is the culture of China is to dismiss several thousand years and some of the great dynasties in the history of China. So that effort at control is something new in the history of China. And when they took over Hong Kong in the late 90s, it was an SAR, Special Administrative mm-hmm. Region. It was supposed to be guaranteed to have certain fundamental rights to be protected, certainly in keeping with the agreement with England, the Great Britain, for the takeover. Slowly, the Chinese government has eroded all mm-hmm. of that, to the point now, as we see with Jimmy Lai, one of the great defenders of democracy in the world, that anything is now possible. And I think the people in Hong Kong see that. And we talked about prophets in Fulton J. Sheen. One of the great prophets of this has been Cardinal Zen, the former bishop of Hong Kong, who has lived through this. He himself has been arrested. He himself has been put on trial for what the Chinese call anti-democratic or anti-party activities.
Yeah, seditious activities.
Seditious activities, yeah. So this is a warning to everyone, but at the same time, we are seeing very similar totalitarian movements in vacating speech, limiting the rights of speech. I can think, for example, of the case right now in Brazil, where a young woman was arrested and now faces potentially 10 years in prison for commenting in social media that a man is a man and a woman is a woman. So Brazil has introduced some of the most draconian and radical of its transgender laws. And once the laws are on the books, as we see in Scotland, as we see in the United Kingdom, we can get back to them in a second, as we've seen in Canada and in some parts now even in the United States, how a local jurisdiction or increasingly the state itself chooses to interpret some of these laws is going to bring potential arrests, prison sentences, and the silencing of those who do not adhere in an Orwellian fashion to the command of the language.
Some people might say you and I utilizing the term Orwellian is an overreach or an overuse, but this really, Orwell predicted this. The other thing, I think everyone here is wondering, in the 90s when you know control was, it wasn't ceded, but at least allowed to the CCP.
Yeah.
Are any of us surprised that this is happening now?
No, I think Fulton J. Sheen would have been the one to say that the minute you put socialists, communists in charge of a government, this inevitably follows. We go back to, you and I have talked many times about Rerum Novarum.
Yes.
Pope Leo XIII's great, the Magna Carta of Catholic social teaching, in which he warned about socialism in particular, because it is not based in the recognition of the dignity of the human person, but in the overwhelming rights and authority of the state. And it always comes back to one of those fundamental questions. Where do our rights come from mm-hmm. as human beings? Do they come from the natural order created, that we are made in the image and likeness of God, and therefore our rights are inviolable, that they are basic to us? Or do those rights actually stem from given to us by the state? And if something is given, it can be taken away. We know that in great Christian Catholic teaching, Catholic anthropology, that God will never take away that dignity. We may choose to sin, but God won't take back what he's given to us freely out of love as a gift. The state certainly will.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh at that. You're right, you're right. And so that's the state pretending to be God.
Yes, and that was one of the warnings that Leo the 13th gave. And he circled one thing that is really interesting to me, and it's because now it's such in the discussion, politically, socially, property. Do we have a right to own property? And if we do own property, is it ours to dispose of? Is it ours to do what we want with it?
I wish that what you were talking about is a theoretical problem.
Right.
That was so far away. I mean, you remember a time in history when we used to talk about the red tide, you know, and as if it were, you know, just halfway across the world.
Right.
And that no longer is the case.
And we're going to have to pause my conversation with Dr. Matthew Bunsen there because we're running out of time in this segment. But Matthew and I are talking about this reality of communism and socialism and how it is an abhorrent ideology in contrast with the revolution in Christian faith. Archbishop Fulton Sheen saw that clearly. A mutual hero of ours, he diagnosed the problem and gave us a solution in Christ. Continuing on the other side, I'm Marcus Peter.
Feeling worn out, overwhelmed, or just plain tired of feeling tired as a parent? Well, you're not alone. Parenting can drain even the most faithful moms and dads, especially at this time of year.
Join us, Dr. Craig and Lisa Popcheck, for a free Ave Maria radio webinar, Reclaiming the Joy of Parenting, Overcoming Burnout, on Wednesday, March 18th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern.
Get practical, faith-filled tools to recharge your batteries and rediscover the joy of raising Catholic kids. Register now at AveMariaRadio.net.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Steve and Janet Ray here, announcing we are back in the Holy Land, ready to introduce you to our favorite places in the world, the land where God walked. Mass at the most holy sites, pray the mysteries of the rosary where they happened, and experience the Bible in vivid color. We have led over 100 groups through this land, sharing the whole story of salvation. Of all the pilgrimages in all of the world, this is the one you should not miss.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at AveMariaRadio.net.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
And now, the EWTN Family Prayer with Father Joseph.
Family, a prayer that we pray together is a powerful prayer. So please pray together with me, our EWTN Family Prayer. Today we pray for those who are suffering with Parkinson's disease. Lord Jesus Christ, consolation of the afflicted, you are our refuge. We pray for those who are suffering the effects of Parkinson's disease. As they lose their physical strength and abilities, increase their spiritual strength and abilities. Renew their inner spirit day after day, and through their share in your sufferings, give the grace of conversion to sinners. In their weakness, reveal your strength. Give peace and joy to those who care for them. Amen.
When we refer to our Father who art in heaven, are we talking to a God who is far removed from us? On the contrary, says the Catholic Catechism, we are talking to a Father who is close to humble and contrite hearts. We assert that God is in the hearts of the just as he is in his holy temple. He is in heaven, his dwelling place. The Father's house is our homeland. Sin has exiled us, But conversion of heart enables us to return to the Father, to heaven. Christians are in the flesh, but they do not live according to the flesh. They spend their lives on earth, but are citizens of heaven. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, talking with my friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen, whom I was blessed to have met up with in person, and we had an extended conversation. We're talking about Archbishop Fulton Sheen and the things that he taught us about the faith and also about communism. Let's go on to that conversation.
One thing we can go back to Fulton J. Sheen, he was always worried about the impact of universities. Look at 1968, for example. That was the great year of Humanae Vitae by Pope St. Paul VI. But in 1968, too, we had this massive upheaval around the world. The French term was the soixante moutards, so the 68ers. And that was a reference to the massive social and political upheaval that we saw in France. There was also the revolution in the United States and Western Europe. The march through the institutions was one of the phrases that was used in that era.
It was by design.
By design, to advance an agenda for progressive ideas, specifically relating to human sexuality, to
the
questioning of authority, to the reconfiguration of the family, to economic and political restructuring. And they targeted specific institutions, politics, media, and law. Mm. But the other one that they really went for was education. The universities became these significant grounds to transform, basically, what they saw as excessively, unacceptably conservative, traditional faculties and ideas, and bring in these, what they termed as fresh ideas, a new look on the world. And that, of course, entailed the takeover of faculties. And the areas they targeted especially were political science, communication, and media, and the arts, and to some degree, law. As anyone knows, that if you want to be able to control a country, there are certain things you need to do. One is to control how laws are interpreted. That a law that is on the books can be interpreted in a variety of different ways. We've seen that sort of worldview with the U.S. Supreme Court. And then there is media and communications. And in terms of secular media, no one trusts them, in part because it's now been decades of clear media bias, a transformation of schools of journalism from teaching the fundamentals of the ethics of journalism to what is openly called advocacy journalism, in which, as a journalist, I feel, they say, obligated to do my reporting to accomplish certain things, to introduce equity, is one of the terms. To promote an agenda of reproductive rights. So the list is fairly long, and I think we all know it. But then there's also the more interesting part, even more disturbing than that, and here we go back to Orwell. The command of the high ground in culture requires you to have command of the language. And so the obscure philosophers named Jacques Derrida and Foucault, who questioned what is communication, what is language, and seriously questioned through the process of deconstruction, what can we know, can we actually communicate? And to obfuscate, to transform, to enter confusion and doubt into an ability to communicate. It's why also we see the presence of Orwellian-like euphemisms. I will give you two. I just used one. Reproductive care is a euphemism for abortion. Gender-affirming care is another one, which is the, obviously, it sounds entirely benign. Who would possibly be against affirming someone's gender? So it goes back to the state, it goes back also to the use of language to obscure or to camouflage what the real intention is, but also the fundamental reality of what something like abortion is.
Every person sitting here either has children or grandchildren or knows someone who has children or grandchildren who has suffered from the rethinking of the institutional authority where the nuclear family, where the rightful institutions of moral framework have been jettisoned.
That's right.
I want to invite you to speak to that, not just as the intellectual that you are, but also your pastoral heart, the concern that this is where we are, but there really is a pathway forward.
Yeah, there is. Well, first, the we have to acknowledge the heartbreak within families. As you said, absolutely, Marcus, that we have so many families that are multi-generational, who perhaps had at one point 11 grandkids, have grown up, and maybe one or two are still in the Catholic Church. But then we also have, as is always the case, and I know there have been a lot of discussions, is there in fact this movement on the part of young people, Gen Z, Gen Alpha, toward the faith? Now, a lot of it, we're trying to do a lot of research at EWTN News to document, to really understand this phenomenon. It began in an anecdotal way, but I think we are beginning to see numerically that it is affirming that Gen Z's, these two younger generations, are intrigued by faith. They're intrigued by belief. They're intrigued by the stability of the Catholic Church. Because in a world where nothing, I was just talking about Foucault and Derrida and the obliteration of the certainty of language, if nothing, well, what was it, Chesterton, I'm paraphrasing, he said, if you find me somebody who will believe in nothing, I can find you someone who will believe in anything. And they're seeing these realities in culture of people who will fall for anything and left empty.
Yeah.
Whether it's the sexual revolution that promised fulfillment and happiness, whether it's radical feminism that promised happiness, whether it's this belief in these messianic figures who rise and fall. The church, as she always has, offers clarity, offers truth, offers also reality. There is biological reality, but it is also affirmed theologically. And I think young people see that.
Yeah.
The willingness of a priest, for example, to go to jail, to prison, rather than reveal the contents of a confession. Okay, that strikes people as either this guy's crazy. Who would do that if it doesn't matter? The reverence that we have seen and the Eucharistic miracles that we have seen about the Eucharist, the Eucharistic revival in the United States, was a real thing. It was a real phenomenon. And we're seeing the impact of that. But we're also seeing in places like Europe, in Belgium, in the Netherlands, in Scotland, in the United Kingdom, young people showing up in almost shocking numbers, numbers that we haven't seen in 50 or 60 years. They're showing up at the door of churches. They're asking priests. They're showing up in universities. The Newman Centers in secular universities are packed with young people. And what's really interesting is when they ask them, what are some of the names that brought you here? They say things like Thomas Aquinas, St. Thomas More, John Henry Newman. What is kind of interesting too is that the Gen Zs tend to be a little more sober, both mentally, in some ways spiritually, but also physically. The wine consumption, beer consumption, for example, is way down among Gen Zs. That's bad news for the wine industry.
Good news for us.
Right, yes, it is. Their livers thank them. But at the same time, I think it's a reaction to what they have seen with the millennials and the Gen Xers. The baby boom generation, which gave us, so I'm a product of that, life was pretty good. I mean, we had very few problems other than the risk of nuclear holocaust growing up in the Cold War. but there was also there was stability in culture, that the nuclear family still existed. So millennials then really began ushering in. In some ways, I can include myself as Gen X was responsible in a lot of ways for the problems that we have. That we're sort of in leadership now and we're about to hand off to the millennials. And we'll have to see how that plays out.
Yeah.
But the Gen Zs tend to look at those previous generations, and they don't necessarily like what they have seen. That every young person in their heart is looking for a cause bigger than they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's one of the reasons why certain leftist groups like Antifa and others do draw a lot of young people. The other thing to consider about Gen Zs is that they are somewhat suspicious. And so we'll have to see if they, understandably so, because of the cynicism that exists across culture toward almost every institution, that so many, the millennials, felt betrayed in many ways by institutions. And the Gen Zs, I think, are worried about that same thing. Now, let's look at it historically. It was said that Aristotle was firmly convinced that the next generation is going to ruin the world. And the next generation, if I recall, was Alexander the Great.
Mm-hmm.
So mission accomplished.
Generation after him, though.
Exactly. But what I'm saying is that, too, each generation tends to look at the generation that follows, that the world is doomed.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, somehow, we always manage to survive through providence, through the carrying on of the church, as Cardinal, the great Cardinal Francis George said, you know, I will die in my bed, and all of that, and my successor. But if we look at the 20th century, the greatest generation that the generation that preceded it, coming out of World War I, that generation, they were pretty sober too, because they survived the flapper years, the lost generation coming out of World War I. They survived the Great Depression. They were inherently frugal. I think all of you can remember your parents and your grandparents.
Yeah, and saving the bacon grease. Yeah.
That's right. So things are very cyclical, and the important part is that we do everything we can as Catholics to support and build the church for what will be the next inevitable set of cultural crises. And while we're doing it, bring this joy and hope and trust that the Gen Zs are going to come through for us. There may be smaller numbers, but the power of that can transform entire cultures as we have seen in the history of the church.
And we're going to have to cut that conversation I had with Matthew over here. Matthew is completely right. Let us pray and hope that the next generation appreciates the gifts of Western civilization and transforms the culture for Christ. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.